Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Thursday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host Nicholas Lorimer and I'm joined today by an unusually large contingent of guests. Firstly, we have Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I am fine, thanks. I was worried about how that would end. A rather large and contingent was the right word.
But I think you mean number of people.
And that is, of course, Sargon, who's joining us today. And we have a special first-time guest, a intern at the Institute of Race Relations and a heroic fighter for the liberal cause out in public, Duane Essau. Duane, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did. What a glorious introduction that is. No pressure.
Okay, very good. So let's actually start with you, Duane. You are part of a group of people who are taking on the state and its challenges to our its attack on our constitution. You've been involved in a legal case. Why don't you tell us precisely what's going on and where the case is at right now?
So the case is based on our belief in the fact that the National Coronavirus Command Council is not recognized in the constitution. So essentially, we are challenging the legality of the NCCC, as it's called, in the court. So we headed to the Western Cape High Court, and so the
who is we in this case?
So we are a group of people who sort of just concerned citizens is what the papers have called us. It's a number of people, but we are students, people who are have completed their studies, people who are currently working, and we are from Cape Town, Joburg, and Durban. So we headed to the Western Cape High Court, and the judge decided, so we asked for a full bench and we were only given two judges, which was fine. We accepted it. And the court decided that actually they accepted the argument from the state that the NCC is a committee of cabinet. And therefore, since cabinet can constitute committees according to the constitution, the NCCC is allowed and it's legal and all the decisions that it has made is valid. And then we decided we're going to appeal or we're going to ask for leave to appeal, which has now been given to us. So we are on our way to the SCA.
Sorry, can I butt in here? Can I ask Duane something? Duane, you said basically that the government said that it's part or a consequence of the cabinet and therefore it's valid. What was your guy's argument about why it wasn't? Why it was unconstitutional?
So our argument was essentially that the constitution of or the compilation of the NCC with all of its members, who we still do not know who they are, that body is essentially taking over the job of Parliament, and therefore Parliament is sort of bypassed in the entire process of formulating policy, which the government is doing because it has been gazetting the different regulations of the different levels of the lockdown. Mm-hmm. So our argument was essentially that the NCCC is taking over the job of Parliament, which seems to us as if it goes against the spirit of the constitution.
So in other words, essentially what's happening is it's filling the gap that Parliament should fill between between the executive on the one side, the judiciary on the other side, the legislature is now in CCC instead of Parliament.
Exactly. And essentially what is happening is that since the cabinet members are also members of the NCCC, they are sort of, they have oversight over themselves in a sense.
Yeah.
Herman, you want to get in on this conversation?
Yeah. I think a very interesting thing is that we have more than two cases, but the two cases that I've been trying to follow relatively closely in this regard is the De Beer case, where Judge Davis gave his judgment declaring the regulations unconstitutional. And the other one is, of course, Duane's case. And the interesting thing to me that was really pointed out in Judge Davis's judgment in the De Beer case, and I actually had a few discussions with people involved in the Esau case, both in the legal team and in the applicants, among the applicants, and they were quite critical of the De Beer case, saying that, you know, the judge made a significant error in conflating rationality and constitutionality. Now, I don't think they're completely right on that, but I do think what the De Beer case's judgment does offer is a very, very important finding that in terms of the Disaster Management Act, you can issue regulations in one of two ways. It can either go through a truncated parliamentary route, or it can go through, I think, Section 27 of the Disaster Management Act. And what the De Beer judgment said is, you know, because the government decided to go with Section 27 of the Disaster Management Act, the non-parliamentary route, they essentially made regulations with the power of law. And I think that's a very good point that Duane makes, is that these regulations aren't regulations in the normal sense of the word. They are laws. They are very strict laws that that have massive consequences for the liberty of South Africans. So when it comes to the importance of this case, I'm always hesitant as a classical liberal in South Africa to refer to either Zimbabwe or Venezuela, because, I mean, those have become, I mean, it's like the, what, Gallup's law, whatever, that, you know, if you're the moment you refer to the Nazis or the Second World War, you automatically lose the argument because you're example law. Godwin's law is so out there. But sometimes comparisons that you know, fall into the Godwin's law trap are valid. And in this regard, I think the NCCC is a very interesting constitutional test balloon if you consider it within the context of a Venezuela-type situation, where the Maduro government lost its parliamentary mandate, its parliamentary majority, but it created another extra constitutional body, which became this entity through which the Maduro government can just continue governing. So I'm not saying that the ANC is looking at Venezuela for a blueprint, but do not be surprised if elections in this country start going against the ANC and somehow some form of command council in the image of the NCCC exists and, you know, becomes a center of power. That is why I think Duane's case I think that is why this is so important. It's not a theoretical matter like, oh, this is outside of this constitution. If it's outside of the constitution, if it's not parliament, if it's not cabinet, it is a fundamental threat to the constitutional division of powers and democracy in this country. Perhaps not now, perhaps not tomorrow, but there's a dangerous thing called precedent.
Duane?
Yeah, Herman is quite right. Our thinking behind this is that we do not want people to think that we are against the lockdown as such. We understand what the aims were in the beginning and why we needed to implement such strict laws. So our argument is not against that. Our argument is that this is a matter of, this is a principle matter, we think, because if there should be a situation where the Disaster Management Act has to be implemented again in future, we will need to have clarity as to whether or not these types of councils are allowed and whether or not this sort of decision-making that bypasses parliament is allowed. And moreover, to another point that Herman made, is that I don't know if you guys have seen the document that the DA got a hold of that essentially was an internal ANC document that stated that the way that they want to move forward is by emulating the NCCC and using it as a form of centralized government, which means the ANC, this is a sort of a test run for them, a trial period to see how they can use the NCCC to further centralize power. And if we are not careful, this could become a norm in our country. It's like the saying goes, freedom, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And if we are not vigilant, our freedoms might just slip away.
Sarah, final thought on this?
On a slightly sort of sardonic point, if you look at the Disaster Management Act is literally meant to be an aid for the minister, the relevant minister in any disaster, to manage the situation, to do certain things and to make sure certain things happen that are outside of the norm to manage the disaster. It is not to, it's not a sort of a great, doesn't, not mean to create a methodology by which you run your government. But I think we're not surprised that the ANC essentially likes the idea. And if you look at it, the NCCC, I mean, that, doesn't that bring to mind the sort of CCCP of the Soviet days, and the fact that it's a command council? I mean, that's the speak of dictatorships everywhere, particularly left-wing dictatorships. So I think the need to be vigilant is paramount.
Herman, your final thoughts on this?
Yeah. It's very interesting that it's very gratifying that Dwayne and his team got leave to appeal and that it now goes to the next stage. And one thing that I do want to make people aware of is there is a high likelihood that this case ends up in the Constitutional Court, and there is a high likelihood that this case is decided incorrectly. And that, you know, the side of liberty essentially loses this case. But that shouldn't be a depression, or that shouldn't be cause a depression on the enthusiasm and on the vigilance and on the necessity of pursuing this case. Just because you might lose in the court of, the final apex court of the country, it still means something to fight the battle of ideas, to show the world and to show the people of South Africa that if this court decision goes the wrong way, there is something fundamental to be fought for. There is something fundamental to turn out the next time there's an election, to stand up the next time you have the opportunity to engage in the battle of ideas, to support organizations who seek to promote the cause of liberty. Even if you lose, you still get the opportunity to make your case in the court of public opinion. And we at the IRR very firmly believe that, important as all the other power struggles are in the courts, in parliament, at the ballot box, the fundamental place where the battle of ideas must be won, the fundamental place where you must win the argument, is in the mind of ordinary South Africans. And I think that's why Margaret Thatcher said, if you want to win a vote, you must first win the argument. So if you lose in a court, use that opportunity to make the argument, because there's a higher court than just the judicial, structures in this country. There's the court of public opinion, and that's where we need to win.
I think what everyone's mentioned here is very important. This battle with the Command Council is a very important one, considering, as Dwayne laid out, the implications, the precedent that this could set. And so my hat, if I was wearing one, would go off to Dwayne and his fellow concerned citizens for fighting this battle, because it is, I think, a key legal battle in deciding which direction our liberal democracy is going to go, whether it's going to maintain its democratic character or whether it's going to be under serious assault. And hopefully they will triumph in the courts. And if not, then hopefully public opinion will be suitably outraged if the courts fail to check this dangerous precedent. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic today. Now, it's been a bit of a slow day in a lot of ways for us. We've talked about a lot of things this week. And Sara, you wanted to get into something that's been kind of on your mind for a little bit. And that's that, you know, in order to fix corruption, which is, of course, big in the news right now, we don't actually necessarily need to start off by jailing everyone who's corrupt. There's an easier way of doing things, at least to start off with. What were you, well, you see, thinking?
There is an easier way, and the law applies both to the private sector and to the public sector in this regard. And that is that when people commit misconduct, you provide them with essentially a charge sheet, and you put them before a disciplinary hearing. And if on the balance of probabilities, the chair of the hearing is satisfied that they have committed the misconduct, they fire them. Now, what a mistake, and you see it in government all the time. They talk about, you know, these guys who were recently reinstated in Limpopo. They'd been on leave for a year or two, paid suspension while they watched whether processes happened or not. And they, one of the reasons they gave for their reinstatement was that there hadn't been any sort of criminal consequences. And the point, and that's a huge, that's not, but it's a huge mistake, because your disciplinary processes run parallel to the criminal processes. They don't rely on the criminal processes. They don't have to wait for the criminal processes. They're not judged on the same terms as the criminal processes. In other words, if you discover somebody's committed corruption today, by the end of the week, you've got your evidence. By the end of next week, you should be able to have fired them. They've lost a job. And in this environment, that's very important, because most of these people have lost jobs and will never be employed by anyone else ever again. The only problem is that the law and this process contradicts cadre deployment, because usually what the ANC does is if somebody commits misconduct, they just move them somewhere else, up, down, sideways. It doesn't matter, but they don't get rid of them. And the law essentially accepts and recognizes that an organization, whether it be a business or an NGO or a government body, it's the organization is primary. The organization does not exist to employ people. People are employed to serve the good of the organization. And as soon as they stop serving the good, or worse, they serve the bad, they go. And they are replaced by people who can do the job honestly. And I think losing a job, being fired for misconduct, is a quicker and possibly even more effective way of dealing with this problem than waiting to go through the courts.
Dwayne?
I have a question to ask on that point that was just made. Do you not think that the fundamental issue, or the reason why people who are implicated in sort of looting and the theft of public money, do you not think the more fundamental issue there is, in fact, the ANC's cadre deployment policy? Because
absolutely. I mean, I think the real problem is that if you say go this route, which is what, you know, my experience in the private sector has been for, let's say, decades, it actually means that it undermines the entire cadre deployment program. And so the ANC is left with condemning corruption, which it was responsible for and which it carries out, but not being able to actually deal with it to satisfy, for example, the IMF, because the processes for achieving a criminal result are too unsure and too long. So it basically means that the ANC is stuffed.
Herman, do you think that this is a practicable way? So we often talk about how you know, our institutions across the country are under extreme pressure. If you were made president of the country today, would you just start by firing people rather than trying to arrest everyone?
Well, you know, it's a difficult question, because I don't think there's actually a wrong answer. I think these people need to go to jail. But the thing that Sara makes, the point that Sara makes so vividly is, you know, it's not good enough to shout at someone with their hand in the cookie jar, you know, we're going to, you know, tell teacher that you've got your hand in the cookie jar and then running to fetch teacher. Perhaps it's sometimes just good to, as a first step, get their hand out of the cookie jar. And if the if it's a mere step of practicality, if the law allows it so obviously, then I do think Sarah is right that, you know, there's a first step. That doesn't mean that these people have to end, you know, necessarily that, you know, the great injustice they suffer or the great retribution they experience is just losing a job. But in heaven's name, we're working with the money of hardworking taxpayers. If we can, by a short, pragmatic, easy, quick step, get something done, well, then it should be done. And I think Sarah points out rightly is these people have no skills. So, you know, perhaps cutting off the tumor and letting it die will be enough for the country to go on with. It won't be justice, but it'll stop the damn bleeding.
Can I just say, it's not an either or. You basically hold hearings and fire people while the criminal case is being pursued. But if you fire them, they're out of the organization. The practical manipulation of the system is put to an end, and the criminal case can still go on. If they were, if the case for any reason it either falls away or they are found not guilty, and they come back to the employer and say, "Oh, I was found not guilty by a court, or the charges were withdrawn," the answer to that is, "Well, that's great, but it doesn't make any difference to us. We only had to prove on a balance of probabilities that you committed the misconduct. Different test." The fact that the criminal court came to a different conclusion is based on beyond reasonable doubt. Thanks very much for your interest, but you remain unemployed.
But I think the important thing here is that the thing that makes this an impractical step now is we all know that once you get, you know, you don't in the ANC, you never get fired. Mm-mm. You get, you know, redeployed. So the reason people don't think along these lines is the assumption is, you know, it's like a game of corruption whack-a-mole. The boss will pop up somewhere else. So the thing is that we need to turn off the whack-a-mole machine. And then this becomes the obvious pragmatic step that can be done the next day. The trick is really getting the whack-a-mole machine off.
Mm.
Dwayne, yours will be the final word on this.
My thoughts are that as long as the ANC, and many people have echoed this view, as long as the ANC has a cadre deployment policy, we will never be able to rid the public service of corrupt officials, because they will know that they always have jobs. Because of their affiliation to a party. And the other day I saw a video of the former president, Thabo Mbeki, where he said that we have to be careful that the ANC does not become a means for people to enrich themselves, where membership of the ANC guarantees that you will have a job in the public service. And that is essentially what has happened.
Very, very correct. And it is, of course, one of the things corroding state capacity at all levels. Right, now let's turn to our final topic for today, which is the case of South Africa's foreign policy. Now, what brought this to mind was the way that Zimbabwe is once again going through another crisis. This is, you know, there have been many over the past few years, but this is it seems to be a large amount of repression going on right now. There's a crackdown on journalists, there's a crackdown on protests. The economy is once again going through one of its spasms of complete dysfunction. And in the midst of this crisis, South Africa's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Naledi Pandor, has said that South Africa is ready to assist if requested. Now, that already suggests that we would be on the side of the Zimbabwean government in this particular instance, the same one which is sort of brutalizing its population. But it seems to me as if South Africa has a pretty bad record over the last couple, few decades of foreign policy. South Africa has tended to prioritize dictatorships and authoritarian regimes around the world over democratic nations. South Africa, for example, has a fascination with Cuba that is completely ideological and goes back to the ANC's time in exile. You can see that and evidence of that. Like, we have all these Cuban doctors here who are paying a lot of many millions to. And we continue to hold good relations with that country despite the enormous amounts of human rights abuse that goes on there and its fundamental incompatibility with our own constitution. Sara, can you think of a success of South African foreign policy over the last two decades?
Well, let's put it this way. Nothing comes to mind. I would have to, go back and look at the books, so to speak. But I think one of the most – our foreign policy is probably one of the most shameful things that the ANC government has bequeathed us. I mean, the whole idea when we went into democracy was that our – you know, Nelson Mandela stated that our foreign policy would be based on human rights. And it didn't take very long for the only human rights that our foreign policy was based on are the human rights of the oppressors, meaning the people running the governments of the countries we're talking about. Everything from allowing al-Bashir from Sudan into the country when the International Criminal Court had a warrant out for his arrest. The fact that we would really support the absolutely autocratic Zimbabwe government over the people of Zimbabwe is an absolute disgrace. Cuba, the same sort of thing. And it's either we support the ideology because, you know, Cuba's this sort of model of communist Marxist reign, whatever you want to call it. Venezuela, also, it's an ideological thing. It's actually, there's nothing much else tying them together. But we never, ever stand up for the people. And I think what's tended to happen is that if it isn't the ideology of Marxism itself, it's the fact that, and in case of Zimbabwe, Mugabe and ZANU-PF fought for their freedom. And that is like cast in stone. It doesn't matter that they could literally commit genocide, and I don't think our government would come out.
Arguably, they did in the 1980s. Dwayne, you wanted to get in on this.
Yes. I think we didn't have to go to sort of the fringes or the extremes of this debate to see that our country has not been on the side of human rights in our foreign policy. With regards to China and the way the Chinese government treats the people and the way there is just a lack of human rights and freedoms in their country, our government has repeatedly sided with China and with the Russians on many occasions. And as Sarah rightfully pointed out, it's just based off our ideological leanings, and based off the fact that the ANC, as we all know, as sort of this, I don't know, at this point, a Marxist socialist view of where South Africa needs to be, and any country who they see are implementing those sorts of policies, they will support over and above what is right, so to speak.
And just in reference to what Wayne said about China, what the ANC has been told, but I don't think it appreciates, it's got this sort of love affair with China as a communist state that's done really well by adopting a capitalist model for its economy. But the Chinese actually don't have a lot of time for the ANC government. They don't want to get involved in a South Africa that's going down the drain economically, and they want a South Africa that's successful. So communists, whether they may or may not be as a political entity, they are ardent. They are essentially ardent capitalists in the sense of successful economy, and they've even expressed the ambassadors even expressed their concern that, you know, we are not doing things correctly. So I think the ANC is so, I don't know, it's so confused, it's so befuddled, it's in a dreamland. And wow, it doesn't help us make good economic decisions by any stretch.
Very much. You can often tell something about a person by the company they keep and the friends they associate with. And I think when it comes to governments, you can often see the same thing, particularly that the ANC really can. It's got a lot of leeway in foreign policy to be the human rights thing that it always promised it would be, because we're so far away from the rest of the world, because we're not entangled over the rest of the world. We have a lot of scope for a human rights based policy. But anyway, we need to call it to a close now. So I just want to thank everyone for listening. And thank you especially to the friends of the IRR. Your support helps to keep us going, helps to keep us providing that alternative voice in the news and the analysis we provide. Thank you very much for listening. And we will see you next week when we return on Monday with the Daily Friend Show.